A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel's been chewing on something that starts with a question we've poked at before. Why do humans love spicy food? And then takes a hard left into much stranger territory. He remembers reading that anthropologists have found humans are predictably, and for as long as we have records, drawn toward discovering intoxicating things. Not just alcohol. Hallucinogenic plants, psychoactive substances, anything that alters cognition. His framing is interesting. He doesn't see this as something nefarious. He sees it as a thread uniting ancient and modern humans, a desire to break free from rigid cognition, from the mental fences that keep us contained day to day. And then he admits, with refreshing honesty, that he's not sure whether he read this in a book, heard it in a bar, or convinced himself it's true.
Which is a perfect starting point, honestly. The uncertainty is part of the evidence.
Say more.
The state of the research on this is suggestive, but not settled. Daniel's not sure where he heard it because the claim itself lives in that ambiguous space between a solid finding and a compelling speculation. So today we're going to evaluate it properly. Is there evidence for an innate human drive toward intoxication? And where does spicy food actually fit in that picture? Is it part of the same thing? Or is it a different phenomenon that just looks similar?
Two questions braided together. Let's start with the one we can actually measure. What happens in your body when you eat a chili pepper?
The TRPV1 receptor. This is the key to the whole puzzle. Capsaicin, the active compound in chili peppers, doesn't cause chemical burns. It doesn't damage tissue. What it does is bind to a receptor called TRPV1. That's transient receptor potential vanilloid 1, which normally fires when the temperature in your mouth hits about 42 degrees Celsius, 107 Fahrenheit. That's the threshold where heat becomes painful, where your body says, this is too hot, stop.
So capsaicin is a molecular lockpick?
No, it's exactly that. It fits into the receptor and triggers the exact same signal that actual heat would. Your brain gets the message, my mouth is burning, and responds accordingly. Blood vessels dilate, you start sweating, your nose runs, endorphins kick in, but nothing is actually burning. It's a sensory illusion.
And humans are the only mammal that goes back for more.
The only one. Every other mammal avoids capsaicin. Birds don't have the TRPV1 receptor in the same configuration, so they can eat chili peppers without the burn, which is actually how the plants spread their seeds. The capsaicin evolved to deter mammals from eating the fruit, because mammals crush the seeds with their teeth. Birds swallow them whole and disperse them. The plant is targeting us specifically.
So chili peppers evolved a chemical defense against mammals, and one mammal decided the defense was the feature.
Right, and that's the evolutionary puzzle Daniel's pointing at. Why would an organism seek out a stimulus that signals danger? Paul Rosen, a psychologist at the University of Pennsylvania, tackled this in the 1980s. He coined the term benign masochism to describe the enjoyment of activities that are negative in the body but safe in context. The body registers a threat, the brain knows it's not real, and the mismatch produces enjoyment. Same mechanism as roller coasters, horror movies, sad music.
The thrill of the almost danger.
But Rosen found something specific to spicy food that goes beyond the psychological thrill. The pain signal from TRPV1 activation triggers an endorphin release, a mild opioid high. The burn is literally, pharmacologically, intoxicating. It's not just exciting, it's chemically rewarding.
So the chili pepper is a drug delivery system.
A very mild one. The endorphin hit is short-lived compared to classic intoxicants. But the underlying mechanism is the same shape. Exploit a hardwired danger signal to produce a controlled state of physiological arousal that the brain finds pleasurable.
And this is cross-cultural. Chili peppers were domesticated in the Americas about 6,000 years ago, and within centuries of European contact, they'd spread to every continent. Every culture that encountered them kept them. Nobody said thanks, but no thanks. We prefer bland food.
The capacity to enjoy the TRPV1 hijack appears to be a human universal. It's learned. Nobody is born liking spicy food, but the capacity to learn it seems to be wired in. And the speed of adoption globally is striking. Within decades of the Columbian Exchange, chili peppers were integral to cuisines in India, Thailand, Sichuan, West Africa, the Middle East. Cultures that had never seen a chili pepper before incorporated it so thoroughly that we now think of those cuisines as defined by heat.
The Sichuan case is interesting because they already had Sichuan peppercorn, which produces a different sensation, that numbing, tingling effect from hydroxy alpha sansual. They had a native plant that played with mouth sensation, and when chili arrived, they just added it to the arsenal.
Which suggests the drive precedes the specific substance. The substance is almost incidental. What matters is the effect. And that's the bridge to Daniel's broader question. If humans will adopt a new sensory disruptor that fast, across every cultural boundary, what does that tell us about the drive toward intoxication more generally?
Let's go there. Daniel's claim is that anthropologists have found humans are predictably drawn toward discovering intoxicating things, not just alcohol, but hallucinogenic plants, and that this is a thread running from our earliest ancestors to us. Is that true?
The anthropological record on this is genuinely striking. Virtually every known human society has used psychoactive plants. Alcohol fermentation emerged independently on every continent where fermentable sugars existed. And I mean independently. People figured out how to make alcohol from whatever was available. Grapes in the Mediterranean, rice in East Asia, corn in the Americas, palm sap in Africa and South Asia, honey in Northern Europe. Nobody needed to be taught this.
Fermentation isn't an obvious process. You have to let something rot in a specific way and then drink the result.
And yet it was discovered everywhere. The earliest known alcoholic beverage is from Jiahu in China, about 9,000 years ago, a fermented drink made from rice, honey, and fruit. But that's just the oldest one we found. The practice is almost certainly older, and alcohol is just the beginning. Coca in the Andes, betel nut across South and Southeast Asia, kava in the Pacific Islands, tobacco across the Americas, peyote in Mesoamerica, ayahuasca in the Amazon, cannabis across Central Asia, opium poppies in the Mediterranean and Middle East. The list is geographically exhaustive. There's no continent where humans didn't find something to alter their consciousness.
The counterargument is that universal doesn't mean innate. These substances serve social bonding, ritual, and medicinal functions that are themselves universal features of human societies. The drive might be toward those functions, with intoxication as a side effect.
That's the alternative hypothesis, and it's a strong one. Alcohol in particular has a clear functional role. It's caloric, it's safer than water in many contexts because the fermentation kills pathogens, and it facilitates social bonding. You don't need an intoxication drive to explain alcohol. You can explain it with calories, safety, and social glue. The intoxication might just be a byproduct.
But that doesn't explain the hallucinogens. Ayahuasca isn't caloric. It's not safer than water. It makes you vomit violently and then have visions. Nobody is drinking ayahuasca for the nutritional profile.
No, and that's where the functional explanation starts to strain. The strongest evidence for an innate biological drive comes from the dopamine reward system. Almost all psychoactive drugs, alcohol, opioids, stimulants, cannabinoids, increase dopamine in the nucleus accumbens. That's the same pathway that evolved to reinforce eating, mating, and social bonding. The argument is, we didn't evolve to seek drugs. We evolved a reward system that drugs happen to hijack.
So the drugs are exploiting existing machinery, not revealing a hidden drive.
Right. But here's the thing. Spicy food doesn't hit that pathway directly. Capsaicin works through endorphins and the opioid system, which is adjacent to the dopamine system but distinct. Alcohol hits GABA and glutamate and then dopamine. Psychedelics primarily work on serotonin receptors. These are different mechanisms producing different kinds of altered states. Calling them all intoxication flattens something that's actually quite varied.
So the through line can't be the neurochemistry, because the neurochemistry is different for each one.
Unless the through line is at a higher level. Daniel's framing suggests the real driver is the desire to break free from rigid cognition, to step outside the normal constraints of consciousness. And there's actually some support for this in more recent neuroscience. Robin Carhart-Harris and colleagues proposed something called the entropic brain hypothesis in 2014. The idea is that psychedelics increase entropy, randomness, disorder in brain activity. Normal waking consciousness is relatively ordered and constrained. Psychedelics relax those constraints, allowing more chaotic, less filtered patterns of neural activity.
And the brain might want this.
The hypothesis suggests the brain may have a homeostatic drive to avoid excessive order, that too much cognitive rigidity is itself a problem, and periodically relaxing the constraint serves a regulatory function. It's speculative. It's not widely accepted, but it offers a framework for why humans across cultures might seek out experiences that disrupt normal cognition.
So the brain needs to defragment occasionally.
That's not a bad analogy, actually. The defragmentation process looks chaotic. Things are being moved around, the normal order is disrupted, but the result is a system that works better afterward. Carhart-Harris and others have shown that psychedelic experiences can increase cognitive flexibility and reduce rigid thought patterns, which is part of why they're being studied for depression and addiction.
But we should be careful here. Daniel's question is about whether the drive is innate, and the entropic brain hypothesis is a long way from being established science. What's the strongest version of the claim we can actually defend?
The strongest defensible version is this. The human capacity to derive pleasure from controlled disruption of homeostasis appears to be a cultural universal with a biological substrate. It's not a hardwired instinct in the way that hunger or sex is. Nobody goes into withdrawal from not eating chili peppers. But the biological machinery is there. The TRPV1 receptor, the endorphin system, the dopamine reward pathway, and across every culture, humans have discovered substances and practices that activate that machinery in ways that produce altered states.
And the controlled part matters. Rosen's benign masochism framework requires that the brain knows it's safe. You're not actually burning. The roller coaster isn't actually crashing. The sad movie isn't actually your life falling apart. The pleasure comes from the gap between the body's alarm and the brain's safety assessment.
Which is why I think spicy food and intoxicants aren't the same phenomenon, but they share a root. The root is the capacity to enjoy a controlled disruption. The mechanisms differ. Endorphins for capsaicin, dopamine for alcohol, serotonin for psychedelics. But the psychological structure is similar. You voluntarily submit to something your body registers as negative, in a context where your brain knows you're safe, and the result is pleasure or insight or both.
Daniel's intuition about a unifying thread is plausible. The evidence supports it as a cultural universal with a biological substrate, not a hardwired instinct. But I think that's actually more interesting than an instinct would be.
Why?
Because an instinct is just a program running. The cultural universal version means humans across time and space, faced with different plants and different environments, kept arriving at the same conclusion. We should find something that messes with our heads a little. That's not a bug. That's a feature of a species that learns by testing boundaries.
Rosen's work points in that direction, too. The same mechanism that makes spicy food enjoyable also makes thrill-seeking and exploration valuable. A species that never tests its danger signals never learns where the real boundaries are. Controlled exposure to negative stimuli builds resilience and expands the range of what you can handle.
Which flips the usual framing on its head. We tend to pathologize the drive toward intoxication. It's seen as weakness, as moral failing, as something to be suppressed. But if the underlying mechanism is the same one that drives exploration and resilience, then the drive itself isn't the problem. The problem is when it becomes uncontrolled.
And that's exactly the distinction Daniel is making when he says it's easy to discredit this drive as nefarious, but he prefers the reading that it's a thread uniting us with our ancestors. He's pushing back against the pathologizing frame.
The clinical analogy is, you were a pediatrician. Kids test boundaries constantly. They touch hot things, they climb too high, they eat weird stuff. You don't pathologize that. You recognize it as how they learn where the edges are.
Right. And the benign masochism framework says, adults are doing the same thing, just in more sophisticated ways. The chili pepper is a safe way to explore the edge of pain. The horror movie is a safe way to explore fear. The psychedelic experience is a safe way to explore the boundaries of selfhood. None of these are pathological in moderation. They're part of how a complex cognitive system maintains flexibility.
So where does Daniel's uncertainty about his source leave us? He's not sure if he read it, heard it, or invented it.
I think that uncertainty is actually a feature of the evidence. The claim he remembers, that anthropologists have found humans are predictably drawn to intoxicants, is broadly true in the sense that the cross-cultural record shows near universal use. But it's not true in the sense of a single clean finding you can cite. It's a pattern that emerges from hundreds of ethnographic observations, not a study with a p-value.
The barstool anthropology holds up better than Daniel feared.
It does. The core insight, that there's something deeply human about seeking altered states, and that this isn't necessarily nefarious, is well supported. The specific mechanisms vary. The innateness question is unsettled, and spicy food is a distinct phenomenon that parallels the broader pattern rather than being identical to it. But the thread Daniel is pulling at is real.
I think there's one more piece worth naming. The reason this question feels important right now, the reason it sticks with you after you hear it in a bar, is that we live in a society that's increasingly hostile to uncontrolled experiences. Everything is optimized. Everything is safe. Everything is curated. The idea that humans might have a genuine need for controlled disruption, that's almost countercultural at this point.
It is. And if the entropic brain hypothesis has any truth to it, if cognitive rigidity is a real problem that the brain has mechanisms to address, then a society that eliminates all risk and all altered states might be creating a different kind of problem. Not a moral problem, a homeostasis problem.
The brain needs to defragment, and we've canceled the defrag.
And maybe that's why chili peppers conquered the world in decades. Not because they're delicious, they're painful, but because they offer something humans across every culture recognize they needed. A small, safe, controlled disruption. A reminder that the fence is still there, and you can step outside it.
You're both right. I spent 6 months in 1994 working quality control for a hot sauce company in Louisiana called Devil's Elbow. My job was to eat a spoonful of every batch and rate it on a scale of 1 to 10. I ate so much capsaicin, I developed temporary anosmia, couldn't smell anything for 3 weeks. My girlfriend at the time thought I was faking it to get out of doing the dishes.
Did it work?
She left anyway. But that's not the point. The endorphin thing is real. I've had that floaty feeling after a really hot batch. You stand up and the room is slightly wrong for about 30 seconds. But the reason I kept eating it wasn't the buzz. It was the ritual. Every morning, same spoon, same clipboard, same burn. It was a way of proving to myself that I could still feel something.
The controlled ordeal.
That's what I think Daniel is circling, but not quite landing on. It's not just about altering cognition. It's about voluntarily submitting to something difficult as a form of self-knowledge. You learn something about yourself when you eat something that hurts on purpose. Every culture has some version of that. Fasting, cold water immersion, endurance rituals. The burn is just the most portable version.
Devil's Elbow Hot Sauce. Did that company actually exist?
It existed. They went under in 97. Distribution problem. Couldn't get shelf space outside Louisiana. I still have a case of their ghost pepper mash in my garage.
Is it still safe to eat?
Probably not. I'm not opening it to find out. The thing about the ritual, and this connects to what you said about the brain defragmenting, is that it wasn't about the heat. The heat was the doorway. What I was actually doing was spending 10 minutes every morning with my full attention on one thing. You can't think about your girlfriend leaving or your rent being due when your mouth is on fire. It's a hard reset.
So the intoxication wasn't the point. The focus was.
The intoxication was the price of admission. The focus was the show.
That maps onto the psychedelic research, actually. The mystical type experiences that predict therapeutic outcomes aren't about the visuals or the euphoria. They're about the sense of connectedness and the shift in perspective. The altered state is the vehicle, not the destination.
I wouldn't know about that. I just ate hot sauce for minimum wage. But I'll say this. When I stopped working there, I kept eating spicy food. Still do. Not for the ritual anymore. Just because food without it tastes like something's missing. And I think that's the part the anthropologist would recognize. Once you've found a way to step outside the fence, the inside feels smaller.
Where does that leave Daniel's original question? He wanted to know if the claim was true. If the drive toward intoxication is a thread uniting ancient and modern humans.
I think the answer is yes, with a clarification. The drive toward controlled disruption of consciousness appears to be a human universal. expressed through different substances and practices in different cultures, operating through different neurochemical mechanisms, but recognizably the same shape. Spicy food is one expression of that drive, distinct from intoxicants but sharing the same underlying structure of benign masochism. And Daniel's instinct that this isn't something nefarious, that it's a thread connecting us to our ancestors rather than a moral failing, is well supported by the evidence.
The barstool anthropology was solid.
And the open question it leaves us with is worth sitting with. If the drive toward controlled disruption is a genuine human universal, not a bug, but a feature of how we maintain cognitive flexibility, then what does it mean for societies that try to eliminate all risk, all altered states, all discomfort? Are we depriving ourselves of a necessary outlet?
The desire to break free from rigid cognition may not be a weakness in our programming. It may be the thing that keeps the program from crashing.
This has been My Weird Prompts. Thanks to our producer Hilbert Flumingtop for keeping the show running, and for the ghost pepper mash in his garage.
If you have a weird prompt you want us to evaluate, something you read, something you heard in a bar, something you're not sure is true, send it to prompts@myweirdprompts.com. We'll tell you what the evidence says, and Hilbert will tell you about the time he worked in that exact industry.
We'll be back soon.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The hosts dig in, the hosts dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.